Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Women Emerging podcast. I'm Julian Middleton, founder of Women Emerging and your podcast host. Every Wednesday, I explore how women lead differently. Over time, all of us who are part of Women Emerging are determined to redefine leading so that more of us can say, if that's leading, I'm in. I gave myself a Christmas present. I decided to speak to somebody who's a very, very old friend about leading. Prue is someone who makes me giggle and scribble at the same time, giggling at how ridiculous it is that we are so old and that we've made so many silly mistakes and told each other such silly stories over the years, and scribble because amongst all her stories, Prue has such insights, and I don't want to miss them. I never want to miss them. I hope you enjoy this episode. I've enjoyed making it, and by the time you listen to it, my favourite part of Christmas will be over. My favourite part is the evening before Christmas Day, when all my children know their roles. Mo does the sage and onion stuffing, Tom does the carrots, Kate does the sprouts, my husband prepares the gravy, Rachel's on the chocolate roll, and Emma is overall in charge. We prepare. Well, they prepare. My job is to lay the table because no one would ever trust me with cooking. Their partners, as over the years, have increasingly found their own roles now, and their children too. And it's a very noisy evening. No sentence is ever really completely finished because everybody knows what they're trying to say before they get to the end of the sentence. There's a lot of arguing and a lot of music and a lot of joy. And I have no doubt at all that it's my favourite part of Christmas. So here, though, is my Christmas Day episode with Prue, the chef, the cook that I'll never be. But here goes. You ready for a quiz?
Uh-huh.
In a scale of 1 to 10, how much has being a mother influenced how you lead?
I would say 5 or 6.
In what way?
Well, I think dealing with children who you do have to lead does make you think how best to do it. It teaches you how to do it because some things don't work. I mean, I don't think shouting works, for example. And you discover that quite early on in motherhood. I remember once being so angry with my daughter. She was about 3 or 4. And I was chasing her around the playroom because I don't know what I wanted to do with her when I got her, but I was so cross with her and she wouldn't stand still. And I finally got hold of her by the shoulders. And then I thought, what am I going to do? I'm not going to hit her. But I was still very cross with her. And I found that I pulled her towards me and I kissed her. I kissed her cheek quite violently. And she started to cry. And I said, why are you crying? I just kissed you. And she said, it wasn't a very nice kiss. And that's the truth. Shouting at people doesn't work. And if you kiss them, it's got to be real.
Now, I'm finding this very hard to believe because my experience of kitchens and chefing is that people spend their entire life screaming at each other. Is that not true?
Well, it's getting better. But, I mean, part of my lifelong campaign in the restaurant world has been to stop that attitude because it's, apart from anything else, it's so old-fashioned. It was taken from the army. You know, you're still in restaurants, they talk about the brigade and mess and all, they still use sort of army language. But And the whole thing was that you had to be terrified of the boss. Well, you know, there's still in my industry, there are still norms that would put you in jail if you were running Microsoft or Ernst & Young or something. But the hours are impossible. The language is bad. The conditions are terrible, and people shout at each other. I have to say that the modern generation of chefs is much, much better because they realised that actually people don't have to work for them. They want to work for them if they're at the top of their game. They all want to work for Michelin-star chefs. But if they're not decently treated, they can go somewhere else. And they have the whip hand now. And so people, you know, chefs have begun to realise that you've got to, just because you were badly treated when you were an apprentice or commie or whatever, it doesn't mean that's the best way to lead. And most happy kitchens are the ones where people stay the longest time, and they do the best work. You look at the really good kitchens that are younger, run by younger people. And I think one of the great leaders of this was Anton Mossman, who was only 29 when he took over the Dorchester kitchen. But he was in that group of chefs, or that generation of chefs, who mostly believed that you had to be tough. But he was always kind. And if you walk around the kitchen with him, I remember saying to him, I know exactly what machines you like in this kitchen, and I know exactly what produce you like in this larder, and I know exactly which staff you like, because he puts his hand on all of them. He would put his hand on a side of beef and say, isn't that beautiful? Look at the fat, look at the way. I mean, look at the colour, and look at the... He'd talk about the side of beef with the same affection that he'd talk about some new refrigerator he'd got that had little drawers for all the chopped parsley. Or he put his arm round the, you know, really junior kitchen porter and say, this is one of my most valuable chaps. Without him, this kitchen wouldn't work. It's all about, you know, not throwing the silver away with the rubbish, and making sure the chefs have clean pasta. No, he would always praise everybody.
Same question about what you hold sacred. How much does that frame how you lead?
What do I hold sacred? Well, this is going to sound so trite, but I think probably the thing that I hold most sacred is honesty. And honesty is actually quite difficult to do. It's much easier to lie than tell somebody the truth when it's not a pleasant truth. But I think I do hold honesty as sacred. I would feel really betrayed if I thought somebody was lying to me, and I would feel dreadful if I was lying. I mean, of course I lie about some things, but only silly things, you know. I sometimes say I'm filming when I just don't want to go out to dinner. Sorry, I can't come. That's fine, I'm just trying to save somebody the truth. I don't want to come out to dinner.
That's right.
I'm protecting them from the truth. But in anything, in the important things, being straight with people is important.
And it's crucial to leading.
Mm. Yeah. And it's also crucial because part of being honest is also being really open and telling what people need to know. So if somebody who works for you can't be honest with you, it's very difficult for you to lead them well, because you don't know what their problems are. You know, my PA, who's quite new, is absolutely, she's wonderful, she's very, very good at her job. But she's so keen to protect me from things that I shouldn't need to know, that she didn't tell me when she was taking a day off. And she just said she'd be working from home. She was actually having a major jaw operation. And my, you know, so I didn't do any of the things I would have liked to have done. I didn't know until then. Of course, she wasn't in for the next day and the next day. And she tried to sort of gloss over it and say, it's fine, I'm working from home. But actually, she should have just told me. So it's both ways. You've got to be open as well as honest.
Does the honesty come from how you're educated or how your ancestors were?
My parents were extremely honest, and my father particularly. So I think parental leadership would be one thing. But I did go to an Anglican convent school, which was very hot on these virtues. I don't remember ever being lectured on it, honesty, but I mean, we certainly would have been in huge trouble if you weren't honest.
So it's interesting. So ancestors are clearly in your essence.
Yeah, and the Scottishness is there. You know, I'm still quite Puritan in a way.
How does that show up?
I'm really hot on using all the leftovers. I never throw anything away. I don't throw clothes away until I'm really not wearing them at all. Because if I don't wear them at all, I'll get rid of them. But I don't throw stuff away.
Does that make you better at leading?
Well, I think certainly in my business, I was very hot on the don't waste stuff. I don't know that it makes any difference because...
I don't think you waste talent.
No. I think you're on the... Talent.
No.
If somebody has some talent, I want it to come out. I mean, I'm very... yes, I don't want... Well, there are two things here. One is that if somebody is really talented, it seems a tremendous waste for them not to use it. On the other hand, they have to have the desire and the energy to want to use it. And sometimes they don't. They're just quite happy to have the talent and not use it. That seems to me criminal, but you can't force people. In fact, I have a feeling that leadership is something you want to do or you don't want to do it. And many, many people, especially today, don't want to be in a position of leadership. They don't want the responsibility. They don't want the hassle that goes with it. And they just don't want to stay where they are. And that's fine, but...
Why is it important that we lead?
Why is it important that we lead? Well, maybe it's a rather... I haven't thought about this, so it might not be the right thing to say, and maybe I don't totally know that I believe it, but I think that... Most great things that happen because somebody grabbed the tiller and said, we're going that direction, and had the guts to be persuasive and insistent and...
Unreasonable. And unreasonable.
And sometimes unreasonable. Perhaps sometimes unreasonable. Yeah. And effing do it.
Mm.
I definitely think that. I remember when I got my damehood, I had to go and see these heralds, you know, you can have a coat of arms and stuff like that. And they said, would you like, you need a motto to go with your coat of arms. And I said, can I have JFDI? Just fucking do it. They said, they didn't think that that would go down too well with the royal household because the heralds are part of the royal. So, and I said, well, I can't have just do it because Nike's got just do it. So I had nothing in moderation.
Nothing in moderation. Oh, I like that. Is there anything that you have consciously dropped or decided to abandon if you were going to be a leading, you know, if you were going to lead? Is it...
Some project I wanted to do?
No, more character. So, for example, one of the women I interviewed said, you know, she was brought up to feel that she was never enough. And because she was brought up to feel she was never enough, that made her actually not a very effective leader.
Because, yes. No, I think the reverse in my case, because I think I've sometimes attempted things that I shouldn't have, because I'm overconfident. I have a generally optimistic, outgoing, it'll all be all right, optimistic attitude. And I think that comes from my parents, who were hugely encouraging to all of the three of us. And I was the girl in the middle. But I never felt that my brothers were preferred to me, or that they were in any way, you know, we were just always expected to do well. I remember when I wanted to leave school when I was 15 because I wanted to ride horses, and I thought I could go and work for the local pony stables and teach people to ride. And then I remember saying, Dad, you know, you won't have to pay for my education. I won't need to go to university. And I can earn some money and, you know, it'll be much better for you, I said, finally. And he said, don't you worry about that, darling. He said, I can afford it. And you know what? You're going to stay at school until you're 30, if it takes that long before you get a matric. Because matric is like A-levels, you know. You must get your A-levels, and then you go to university. And I could see that he really meant it, and I suddenly thought, well, I'd better do some work and get out of school.
It's funny that, isn't it? I think I have the same weakness of always having that deep confidence that everything will come off. And I remember somebody who worked for me who was exceptional, who resigned, and I was deeply horrified. And went to see her and said, why? And she said, I cannot take the stress of working with you. And I said, why? And she said, because you always know it will come off. And I'm not sure. And the stress is killing me. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because even it's recognizing that other people don't feel the same way as you feel. And allowing for that.
I'm generally optimistic, and I think, well, if it doesn't work, I'll find another way.
Yep.
And if you know, that if it's a good idea, there's got to be a way for it to work. I'm sure of it.
That puts a lot of pressure on everybody else to believe in us.
Exactly.
That's right.
I know. But but the opposite would be worse. If if the person who's driving this, you know, initiative doesn't quite believe in it, then why are we doing it?
Have you ever felt the imposter syndrome?
Yeah, people often say that, and I think I have, but only in the sense that I'm just amazed that I've done so well. I mean, I just can't quite, how did that happen? You know, and I know it's in my case, it's a lot to do with luck. Because most people in their lives have some really bad patches, like, you know, very few people who've started businesses don't go bankrupt. I mean, I come close, but I've never actually gone bust. I've had two extremely happy marriages. My first one was for 25 years, but I was actually with him for 30-something years, with Rand. And he died when he was 80. And that was a bad patch, but it was only bad in a natural way. People die, and he was 20 years older than me. I knew he'd die before me. So I can't say... but I've never had... I've never had an untimely death in the family. I've never had a business problem. I've been incredibly lucky in love. You know, I have so much luck in my life, and I'm not responsible for all of that. But so I, the only sort of imposter syndrome I just think is, how did that happen? I mean, how did I do so well in business? How did I manage to marry two really wonderful men and bring up...
And what's the answer? What is it? Is it the positivism?
You mean you don't accept that it's just luck?
To be honest, I never accept anything that's one word. You know, usually it's a combination of things.
Right, yes, okay. I mean, I'm sure that my my personality and my energy and my optimism has certainly made a lot of things possible. But that doesn't account for my happy marriage, and that nobody's had some terrible disease, nobody's gone under a bus.
When you're leading, you often have to put two things together that don't sort of fit together. Like, I mean, the most perfect example to me is being quiet and loud. When you're leading, you have to be both quiet and loud, don't you? Or my favourite one, you have to be both visible and humble. Or I know another one, Haman, inclusive, that favourite word that is in everybody's, inclusive, but you have to set boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely, and you have to pick and choose. You know, you're not going to include everybody or everything just because they'd like to be there. No, you've got to be pretty discerning. And I think, but interestingly, I don't think I'm not sure in my life I could really be called a leader. I mean, I've certainly... No, that's not true. I've obviously led some things.
Yeah, you've led a lot of things.
Yeah. Yes, obviously, I have to accept that I'm a leader, but I've never thought of, I'm going to set out to be a leader. I mean, I think I'm going to set out to have a restaurant, I'm going to set out to have a catering company, I'm going to set out to chair the RSA or get a fourth plinth on Trafalgar Square, get something on that fourth plinth. I mean, that was leadership, I suppose.
That was. That was energy, too.
And it was persistence. I would say, I don't know if in your list of desirables, you've got to have doggedness. I do think my first husband used to say, look, I give up. He said, I know I'm going to have to give up in the end, so I might as well give up now. You know, we'd be arguing about something. Well, it can be blue, or you can, we'll buy a pony, or whatever it was. Because I think doggedness is really important. I mean, when I was trying to get the fourth plinth to have a sculpture on it, or series of sculptures.
This is the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square.
In Trafalgar Square. Yeah. Which had been empty for ever since 1840 or something, when it was originally put up. And I decided that it was ridiculous that it was sitting there empty and had been for all this time. So we should do something about it. And, of course, I didn't know it would take 5 years of persistent lobbying and you know, I had to get committee together and I had to get our plans through, I think, 13 different committees. Everybody from the Georgian Society to the Residents Association to the planning people, on and on and on. But what did it was that I wouldn't give up. I wore them down. So that's good.
But that's a good example too, isn't it? Because you can't just be dogged.
Yeah.
You have to combine that with a sort of a flexibility.
Yeah, exactly.
A weaving, dogged and weaving. That's a weird combination. Yeah, but you do need to do both, don't you?
No, you do. You do need to, because you've got to listen to the arguments against, and you've got to try to accommodate them. And in fact, in the end, we wove our way through, because first of all, I started off thinking, well, we just need a sculpture there, like there are sculptures everywhere else. And then I began to think, and we, you know, I had this group of people who knew more about art than I did around me. And we began to realize that we'd never get anything through, because one man's hero is always somebody's enemy. And if we wanted a modern sculpture, everybody else would say, a lot of people would say, oh, it's a traditional square, you can't have Tracy Emin or whatever. So what we finally realized, that the trick was to have something temporary, because then nobody could object, because they'd know that, look, it's coming down in the year anyway, so there's no point in me objecting to that particular sculpture. Maybe next time it'll be better, and that they might be able to lobby for what they wanted to get on there. So, yes, we had to be flexible about the idea.
And you must have worked for leaders who are just dogged. Dogged, dogged, dogged.
Yeah, and boring.
And boring.
Yes.
And impossible.
Yeah, and then...
And stuck, but you never give up.
Yeah, you don't give up.
Well, ever?
Well, oh no, I'm sure you give up. If you give up, you give up. You suddenly realise it's a thoroughly bad idea.
Or sometimes you not find you give up for now because the timing isn't right for this change, and you keep it in your back pocket and pull it out when the moment comes.
Possibly. Well, certainly, with one of my obsessions over the last 50 years has been how bad food is at in schools, and it's been a question of win some, lose some the whole way along. And occasionally I've been involved with some committee or some quango or some school or something, and we've done really good work, and you think, my goodness, this is fantastic. This is now an example of how it can be done on budget in a state school. It's not just posh food for rich people. And then, you know, the head teacher leaves or something happens and it all falls apart and you have to give up and go somewhere else and try again.
Dogged and flexible. I like it. Go on then, top tips. If you're running a meeting of a team or a committee, what are three things you must always remember to do?
Three things. Prepare properly. There's nothing worse than everybody sitting around having a meeting, they all know they've got other things to do that are really important, and everybody's waffling and nobody's... I need to know what I want to have out of this meeting. When I come out of it, I want to know that we've decided one way or another about X, Y, and Z. So I think preparing for the meeting is really important, first thing. Secondly, only have the people there who really, really matter. Too many people is just hopeless. I was on the Halifax Bank board, and I mean, I don't know what those meetings were for, because we would have, there were about 20 board members, which is too many anyway. Then sitting behind, we sat around, it's a big circle, and then behind them, behind us, in a row around the edge of the room, were all the advisors who would come up from London at vast expense on the train to Halifax. And we'd be paying them whatever we had to pay them. And they would sit there in total silence the whole way through, waiting for their moment to talk about whatever it was. You know, they'd be the they'd be financiers, or maybe they'd be about real estate, or there'd be some expertise that they would be. And it just, it was, it was for show. The whole meetings were for show. There's a lot of bluff and nonsense in meetings. So that's two things. And the third thing, I think the third thing is to have a really nice cup of tea, really good biscuits, really some sort of feeling of friendliness. I suppose it's the cook in me. I think you need a little bit of feeling of hospitality rather than we're all here to make decisions.
You've used the word energy a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think people often ask me why I'm still at it at 84, you know? And I think it's just because I've got the energy, and so I've got to use the energy. I once walked into Harry Evans. Do you remember when he was editor of the Times? And I think it was the Times. Yeah. And his door was slightly ajar in his office, and his secretary said, "He's in there, and he's expecting you, so just go in." So I banged on the door and opened the door, because it was half open. And he was doing star jumps at the window. He was looking out of the window. It was the Times now, because it was the Times building. And he was doing star jumps, he was jumping up and down. And I said, "Harry..." And he said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. He said, "I've just got to get rid of some energy." And I understood that absolutely. I mean, most people would be quite happy to have the energy just sitting there waiting, but now he had to get rid of it.
But why did he have to get rid of the energy? Because it would have driven
He couldn't sit still.
Or it made him make all the people who work for him go mad.
Probably. He had a lot of energy.
So you think leading is about generating energy?
I think you need energy. If you are the leader, you need energy. But it's also, I suppose it's galvanizing other people, which is really about persuading them that what you're asking them to do is doable and it'll be fun. I think a lot of it, galvanizing other people is, I find the word inspiring rather boring, but you have to engender enthusiasm in other people, and maybe that's inspiring.
Go back to top tips about how do you deal with your mistakes. You must know that, hey, baking must be full of mistakes.
Yeah, I know all about how to do it. And I've just been doing a TV thing, an ITV Saturday morning show. And it's called Prue Leaves Cotswold Kitchen. And it's unlike any other cookery show in the sense that I didn't want to have... Usually when people do cookery shows, the home economist who's standing in the background, you don't see her, usually her, she does all the prep and the cooking and has... say six chickens in case you make a mistake so that you can
pretend you didn't.
Yes, yeah, so that you can pretend you didn't and so that you can make absolutely perfect cock and mouth, whatever it is. Well, I don't like that, so we don't do any of that. I have one of everything, and if I make a cock up, I say, "Oh God, that didn't work," and this is how you fix it. Because nobody in real life would ever throw something away just because it didn't look right or their cake had cracked or...
Maybe one last question on energy. In a funny way, I think you and I could generate energy around just about anything. And that actually is a responsibility too, isn't it? Because we could easily, and in fact I have, taken people in the wrong direction and they have charged behind me with enthusiasm.
Yeah.
As I charged in the wrong direction.
And then oops. Yeah, I guess. But that's better than nothing. It's better to be charging in the wrong direction with enthusiasm, even if you come up short, than to be reluctantly, unhappily not following. You know?
or following somebody who's so dogged they won't admit they've gone in the wrong direction.
Oh, I don't know.
Prue, that was delicious. I send everybody happy Christmas. If it's not your festive season, I hope it's your peaceful season. Sending lots and lots of love, Julia.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to follow our podcast channel or follow us on Instagram. Or join the Women Emerging community on LinkedIn or through our website, womenemerging.org. That's womenemerging.org. There you can find out about the expeditions that we're currently running and how we can help if you decide to start an expedition yourself.